The Chitauri are coming. Nothing will change that. What have I to fear?
The Avengers. That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team. Earth's mightiest heroes type thing.
Yes. I've met them.
Yeah. Takes us a while to get any traction, I'll give you that one. But let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod. A super soldier, a living legend who kind of lives up to the legend. A man with breathtaking anger management issues. A couple of master assassins, and you, big fella. You've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
Not a great plan. When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
Oh, I thought the Beast had won it off.
You're missing the point. There's no throne. There is no version of this where you come out on top. Maybe your army comes, and maybe it's too much for us, but it's all on you. Because if we can't protect the Earth, you can be damn well sure we'll avenge it.
Hello everyone, welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and I am here by myself again today, which happens occasionally. That's the way this business goes in the volunteer radio business, and sometimes people get busy, but that's okay. We're going to proceed anyway. Like, I'm not here by myself, even though I am. Hopefully I won't feel that way. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the ultimate chapter of the Marvel Cinematic Universe Avengers Endgame. Now, that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, usually we talk about some movie news from the past week, but I'm going to retire that because it's no fun talking about the news all by myself. Anyway, enough pity me moments. So instead we're going to do, what I'm going to do, and you will listen, is I am going to do a countdown of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies in order from what I think are the best to, I won't say the worst, like none of these movies are like well and truly bad, but I will say from best to not as good. Maybe not as good as we'd like, not as good as we'd hope, you know, one of the two. Anyway, before that, I'm recording on Monday. The show plays Wednesday afternoon, but we usually record like Sunday afternoon or Monday evening or something. I literally just got this on my phone. John Singleton, the groundbreaking film director, screenwriter, producer, died Monday in Los Angeles after suffering a stroke on April 17th. He was 51. You may know John Singleton as the director of Boys in the Hood. He's directed several films, some like on deeply personal, like Boys in the Hood, or Four Brothers, or he's directed like big, you know, silly summer blockbuster affair like Too Fast, Too Furious, and the Shaft remake from 2000. So it's a really sad note to sort of start the week on. That John Singleton has passed because he's such a trailblazing filmmaker. And it's worth noting he was the first black director to ever receive an Academy Award nomination for Best Director. And this was in 1991 or 2 for Boys in the Hood. So, I mean, that goes to show you just sort of how far or unfar we've come in terms of the diversity problems in Hollywood, that the first time someone with black skin was nominated as Best Director was barely 30 years ago. So rest in peace, John Singleton, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this more deeply and talk about his films more on next week's show. For now, this was supposed to be the All Marvel Hour, and as I said, we're going to celebrate that by talking about the first 21 Marvel movies, Marvel's Avengers Endgame, now in theaters is the 22nd. So I'm going to now take 30-35 minutes to rank the first 21. Okay. So we're going to start first with Iron Man, which was the first MCU movie, and I have it as number one. And I think one of the things people may not appreciate was what a tremendous gamble this movie was. It was Marvel Studios self-financing. And this was before they were part of Disney. I think they were bought by Disney in 2009. So this was when they were making this in 2007. They were still kind of on their own as a separate entity. So they invested $100 million of their own money on a C-list character. Not like, unless you were like steeply into comics, you didn't know who Iron Man was. The director was the guy who made Elf, Jon Favreau, who, you know, has since done a lot of various things, like big blockbustery things. But he was mostly at the time known as the guy who made Elf. And the star was Robert Downey Jr. And for some of you who may be of the younger persuasion, at the time, Robert Downey Jr. had literally burned every bridge in Hollywood. At the turn of the century, he was in and out of rehab. People would, you know, bank on him for film appearances. David E. Kelly pretty much wrote a whole season of Ally McBeal around introducing his character. And then about halfway through, Robert Downey Jr.'s issues started taking hold again with addiction and things. This was a gamble, Iron Man, I mean. So it comes out the other side of 11 years of world building as sort of like the pinnacle. I don't think the rest of the universe would exist without Iron Man, and I think that's pretty safe to say. At the same time, when you rewatch Iron Man, it stands on its own pretty well. If you take out like the end credits, the name of the show, but if you take out the post-credit scene with Nick Fury and the mentions of S.H.I.E.L.D., it would pretty much stand on its own as kind of this standalone thing, a one and done, and it would still be perfectly fine. But the fact that it kicked off this whole universe and the fact that it turned Robert Downey Jr.'s life around, made them this huge star, made him the centerpiece of this mega franchise that covered nearly two dozen films, is really remarkable. So, but I think Iron Man ranks number one because it kind of stands on its own still. It's the one that kicked it all off. And I think it really showed what you could do with the characters. And taking the hero seriously, too, because a lot of these movies until this point were kind of inordinately focused on the villain and who the villain was and what big stars you can get to be the villain. And the hero was felt kind of secondary. If you don't need a good example of that, look at the Batman films of the 80s and 90s. So for all those reasons, I think Iron Man stands at a solid number one place. Moving on to number two is Avengers, the first Avengers in 2012. Again, this would seem like another impossible task. Like, how do you take all these different characters and put them in a combined team movie? Something like the X-Men kind of is born out of the fact it is by nature a team exercise. But the Avengers, you're bringing characters who were introduced all across different movies and putting them into one movie that had to be its own text, kind of had to stand alone, while at the same time bringing in all these influences and characters and side characters and storylines from all these various other movies. I think there were five that preceded the Avengers. You also get Joss Whedon, who is kind of the perfect person who like really understands team dynamics. It is also very much his voice. And one of the things I remember that's very surprising when the Avengers came out was how clear Joss Whedon's voice is in that movie. And at the same time, he was able to recontextualize some of these characters. I think Black Widow is one. Hawkeye, who actually appears in the first Thor movie, but I don't think you actually see his face in the first Thor movie. Joss Whedon's able to introduce these characters in kind of new and refreshing ways. Hulk as well, because Mark Ruffalo, this is his first time playing the Hulk. He was not in The Incredible Hulk, which we will get to later in the list. Number three is Black Panther. It is, I think, the game changer of the MCU in so much as, I guess, almost Iron Man in its own way, too, is a game changer. I think Ryan Coogler, who is just like on a the best first three film streak I think anyone's ever had, really comes in and makes a character his own, even though the character was introduced in a previous Captain America movie. He's able to come in and use his own influences and his own styles and his own directions to make the Black Panther character its own thing and sort of stand uniquely apart while still being part of that broader Marvel universe, because there are actually a lot of crossover characters in it as well, including Black Panther, including, what's his name from Sherlock? Not Sherlock Watson. I'll remember it later. But he's in it. Andy Serkis returns as a villain in it. It could have been, like, a lot of these Marvel movies that are kind of, like, picking up from past episodes and sort of going on to their side to kind of feel like they're recycling things. They're recycling a lot of the visuals. They're recycling a lot of the characters. They're recycling a lot of the sort of the plot and theme elements, a lot of the raw material. Black Panther comes out, and it feels very, very different. It strikes a very, very different tone. And it has one of the best villains in the Marvel Universe in Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger. And it gives us a villain who is actually very identifiable and very understandable and kind of has a point. It's a very interesting movie, and I don't think you can contextualize it without the social part of this, how it's a predominantly Black cast made by a Black filmmaker. I think there are a lot of different reasons why this should be at number three. Number four, I think, is Guardians of the Galaxy. It was kind of like a really out there choice, in so much as like Iron Man, you can call him a C-list character. Guardians of the Galaxy were like D, almost E-list characters. And then you bring in James Gunn, who is was known for working for Troma, the Lloyd Kaufman company that makes these really cheesy B movies out of New York. Toxic Avenger is among them. So you give him $100 million budget, and you give him a cast that includes a talking tree and a talking raccoon and like a green ninja assassin alien chick and cyborg and, you know, all these elements, and it works surprisingly well. It's also kind of like the first kind of out-and-out comedic Marvel movie, which the movies have tried to various extents. You know, some of the Marvel movies are more comedic than others. Guardians is like the first to like go like kind of full comedic. And I think that's by and large thanks to Chris Pratt. Also Dave Bautista. Dave Bautista was a pro wrestler, has become like a really serious actor. And I don't mean like serious, like dramatic, like he's not doing Shakespeare in the Park, but I mean, he's like really honing his craft. You look at him in Blade Runner 2049 or Inspector. He's also got a couple of comedies coming out. He's someone to watch. He might be the next Rock, I think, or the next Dwayne Johnson. So that brings us to number five, and that is Captain America, the Winter Soldier. It is an interesting continuation of Captain America's storyline. It's the first like full adventure, for solo adventure for him in the modern world. And it really works to subvert everything Captain America thinks he knows about America and what he was fighting for as a World War II soldier. It has this great sort of feeling of a 1970s spy thriller, like 3 Days of the Condor. And it's fitting because you have Robert Redford in it as the head of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it really quite has its own flavor and its own tone, and it's a really great continuation of the Captain America storyline, where it's also sort of continuing the broader storyline of things in the Marvel Universe and the politics of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it really, you know, tells Captain America what he is fighting for in the modern world. Six. Spider-Man Homecoming. And again, I think this sort of typifies the best of the MCU is when it goes for a different flavor. So in Spider-Man Homecoming, you have John Hughes as a superhero movie, or a lot of it is very based in Peter Parker's high school experience and like asking the girl he likes to the dance and trying to balance work life as Spider-Man with school life as Peter Parker. You also have, again, this is another great villain in the film. You have Michael Keaton as the Vulture, and the Vulture is like when you absolutely cannot get any of the other main Spider-Man rogues gallery, you go to the Vulture, because in the comic books he's kind of this old guy in a plastic wing suit. In Spider-Man Homecoming, you get Michael Keaton as the Vulture. He has a very understandable sort of raison d'etre as the villain. He's kind of really intimidating. And the scene where Michael Keaton is taking his daughter and Peter Parker, unbeknownst to Peter Parker, that his crush's father is his main adversary as Spider-Man. And the revelation in that scene is really incredible and really well acted, I mean. And I think that's probably maybe one of my most favorite scenes in the MCU ever, is when Tom Holland and Michael Keaton face off in that car right before the homecoming dance. Number seven, I have Ant-Man, which, again, is this fun little heist movie. It's also, comparatively low stakes, because it's about, trying to stop this one guy from trying to duplicate the Ant-Man formula, and it's this great, big cast, with Michael Peña as Ant-Man's friend, who was also his friend in jail, and a really great dynamic there, it's just this fun little tight family movie. It's weird. It weirdly calls back, and actually, Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is number nine, for me, kind of calls back to these sort of heydays of these Disney sort of family adventure movies, albeit with bigger budgets. And both these movies have a lot of fun with that. I mean, there are serious stakes, of course, but it's not they're not deeply serious movies. They're a lot of fun. And I find, especially when you get to Ant-Man and the Wasp, where it came out right after Infinity War, there are these great, both examples come out of Ant-Man movies come out after Avengers movies. And it's sort of a great sort of palate cleanser, coming out of these big crossover movies to have this small Ant-Man adventures. So Ant-Man and the Wasp is number nine, but go back to number eight, I have Thor Ragnarok, which has another one of these movies where it somehow lets the director voice come through, and you have Taika Waititi, who is, I think, half indigenous, Australian indigenous person. So he brings this very thematic material about colonialism to Asgard. And again, you have this out-and-out comedic adventure on top of that. So there's this very serious theme going on, but it's explicitly comedic with Thor losing his hammer and being sent to this gladiator world where he's forced to fight the Hulk and all that. I mean, it's dark because Ragnarok, of course, is the end of the world in Norse mythology. So you have the end of the world and out-and-out blatant comedy with the Thor characters. And it's really quite a fascinating mix. And it's a movie that only Taika Waititi could have made. Before I take a break, I will give you my number 10, which is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And this will play into the review of Endgame, because Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 has actual consequences. There is actual consequences to the action in terms of one major character doesn't make it to the end of that movie. And I think that's something that we can acknowledge has been missing from a lot of these Marvel movies. It's the feeling of genuine stakes and the feel of genuine gravity, that there are consequences to actions. Sometimes people don't make it out alive, and it feels like Marvel's kind of avoided that because you never know who's going to be useful later. You know, you can't kill, let's say, War Machine, because War Machine might be valuable at some point later on in the film series. So I do like that about Guardians, and of course it sort of let James Gunn be even more James Gunny than in the original film. It had a great villain in Kurt Russell as well. So that was number 10. I'm going to take a break before moving on to the other 11 items on the list, and I hope you enjoy this very thematically appropriate music. Anyway, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU.
Can't sleep?
Get the jitters, I guess.
Me too.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
Why me?
I suppose that is the only question that matters. This is from Augsburg, my city. So many people forget that the first country the Nazis invaded was their own.
You know, after the last war, that my people struggled. They felt weak, they felt small. And then Hitler comes along with the marching and the big show and the flags and the and he hears of me, my work, and he finds me. And he says, you. He says, you will make us strong. Well, I am not interested.
The serum amplifies everything that is inside. So good becomes great. Bad becomes worse. This is why you were chosen. Because a strong man who has known power all his life may lose respect for that power. But a weak man knows the value of strength and knows compassion.
Thanks, I think.
And that was a clip from Captain America, the First Avenger. And that is number 11 on my list. I think Captain America, the First Avenger is probably an underrated gem in this series. Mostly because, you know, it casts Chris Evans as Captain America, who's such a great find, who, you know, if you watch Chris Evans in any number of movies before this, he's playing such a cocky a-hole in a lot of them. Even, like, he was in the Fantastic Four, the Tim Story Fantastic Four movies, and the Human Torch, and of course that's, like, a very cocky role as well. But, I mean, there are a lot of them where he's just kind of a jerk. Could he embody the qualities, you know, we would expect from somebody like Captain America? And surprisingly, the answer is yes. He plays the heck out of Captain America. The film also gives us Hallie Atwell as Agent Carter, who's much more than a love interest in this movie. She's like a really great character in her own right. And you kind of instantly understand why Captain America would fall in love with her. I mean, yes, she is the love interest, but Hallie Atwell gives her a little bit more than that. And, you know, it's a great cast with Hugo Weaving as the Red Skull, Tommy Lee Jones being basically General Tommy Lee Jones, you know, Toby Jones is Zolo, one of the Nazi henchmen. Even, you know, it's like when you get to the Howling Commandos, when you have Sebastian Stan as Bucky, and you have... I can't remember his name, but he plays Dum-Dum Dugan. Neil McDonough, he plays Dum-Dum Dugan. It's just great casting top to bottom. Plus, you have Joe Johnston at the helm. Joe Johnston, if you don't know, is kind of responsible for everything you love about the original Star Wars trilogy and much of, you know, sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark. He worked for Lucasfilm for years. He designed the Boba Fett costume and was involved in a lot of the artistic direction of the original Star Wars trilogy and the first couple of Indiana Jones movies. Plus, he did The Rocketeer, and if you are a certain type of fan, The Rocketeer is near and dear to your heart. I am one of those people. I love The Rocketeer. I have it on Blu-ray. I try to watch it at least once a year. It is such a whiz-bang sort of callback to the 30s and those adventure serials. So Joe Johnson's really the perfect guy to make the first Avenger, Captain America. So number 12, we have Captain Marvel, another captain. this could be recency bias at play, but I still really enjoyed Captain Marvel. The casting of Brie Larson was so perfect. She just is so great in that role. She has like sort of bottomless optimism, but she's also kind of, you know, she can be the warrior woman. She can be playful. She can, you know, be funny. And that was a real joy to watch. The 90s nostalgia of the movie is kind of fun too. I know that some people are kind of turned off about the girl power message, because it feels very 90s, especially when it breaks out into No Doubt in the middle of a fight scene. But, you know, I still enjoy that. And, you know, call me a marshmallow, but I was a pushover for that stuff. Number 13 I have Avengers Age of Ultron. I like this probably better than most people. I find that you can see the push-pull between what Whedon wanted to do and what Marvel wanted him to do. And there's a definite friction in the midst of the film where you have Marvel wanting to do all this like sort of story arc building stuff, and Whedon's like, no, I want to go out and hang out with Hawkeye's family for an hour. Some of it pays off very beautifully, actually, in Endgame. So maybe someone at Marvel owes owes Joss Whedon a glass of whatever beverage he would like. But I find the fact that it fleshed out Hawkeye's backstory and, you know, Black Widow's backstory, and it was able to still pause and do these things, like the scene at the party where they're all trying to lift Thor's hammer. Again, that's something else that plays off in Endgame. It just seems like it's a film with sort of two minds, and that's very obvious, but I think it still wins out. Plus, I have a lot of, actually, admiration for James Spader as Ultron. I like his interpretation of Ultron a lot. I like this kind of, like, sassy James Spader, like, robot who's just always talking about ending the world. Number 14, I have Iron Man 3. I know a lot of people who are fans of the MCU aren't necessarily fans of this movie, and maybe it's because of the twist involving the Mandarin, who has been a long-time Iron Man villain in the comic book, but is kind of like this really horrible stereotype as well. So I'm not sure why people are so disappointed about that. At the same time, it's a Shane Black movie. It's not a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. It's a Shane Black movie. It has all like these buddy cop elements with Robert Downey Jr. and Don Cheadle as Rhodey. You know, it's very written to sort of Shane Black's taste, shall we say, which is one of the reasons why I found his Predator movie so surprising, because it's like it really didn't seem like to come out of the Shane Black mold. I don't know what happened there. I find it interesting that Disney let Shane Black take the wheel of this, and maybe this is where Robert Downey Jr.'s influence came into play, because they're not going to say no to Robert Downey Jr. after making, you know, several billion dollars as Iron Man. But to let, you know, Shane Black come in and just do whatever Shane Black wants and whatever RDJ wanted to do, it's really something else. And it's kind of like, on this list, it's kind of like the last of the departures, where you kind of get a more artistic vision for these movies. I'm coming now to 15, Captain America Civil War, which, again, is one of these movies that has sort of two minds. On the one hand, it is, I don't know, it's a really good completion of the Captain America arc over three movies, where he, in the first one, he joins the army full of patriotic fervor, ready to do his duty, and by the time he gets to the end of the Civil War, it's like, I've given everything I can, I've made the right decisions, and, you know, making the right decision here means I can't be Captain America anymore. And it's kind of perfectly summed up when he just drops the shield and walks away. There's that part of it. The other part of it, too, is that it's like Avengers 2.5, which a lot of people have joked about, but it really does feel that way, where you get all these characters together in this Super Smash Brothers bash 'em up. And again, there's no real consequence, and I alluded to this earlier, is that one of them should have died. And I mean, the most obvious choice was Rhodey, and it's a shame to say that, you know, you would want to lose one of the only major black characters. I mean, to this point, now we have like a whole Wakanda full of black characters to play with, but that would kind of be bad. On the other hand, it would fit in with the comic book version of Civil War, where the first major fatality was one of the black characters, too. But I digress. Number, what is it, 16? Avengers Infinity War, which was the last Avengers movie, came out last summer. I remember saying last summer when Candace and I reviewed it that my feelings about Infinity War would largely depend about how things play out in Endgame. And I will tease and say that I'm actually fairly pleased with how everything paid off in Endgame. I'm not sure my feelings about Infinity War have changed. I mean, it does the hard work of setting the stage, setting the scene, and getting all the characters together and sort of giving them enough mechanical assistance to launch them off onto this adventure that they've been building up to for 20 movies. But there's kind of like no kind of moment to let things simmer, to let things, you know, develop. Of course, in Age of Ultron, there's this sort of Hulk Black Widow romance that is hinted at. And when the two characters end up in the same room together in Infinity War, it's just like, oh, hey, how are you? And then off we go to the other adventure. So I it's tough to you know, get past this movie. It's just like 2.5 hours of just sort of solid action and solid setup for the movie that we're going to review later on. But there you go. Number 17 is Doctor Strange, which is a movie I should have liked more. But I feel like, again, there's too much stuff going on where characters service plot rather than plot servicing characters. You know, you sort of have Rachel McAdams here in kind of a wasted part. You have a turn at the end where someone decides to become a villain because, you know, in the comic book they've always been a villain. You have Benedict Cumberbatch, who I'm not sure is, outside of Sherlock, is great leading man material, because I've actually enjoyed Doctor Strange in Infinity War and in the brief part he played in Thor Ragnarok. I have not really enjoyed Doctor Strange in his own solo movie, which is bizarre. But it's tricky. I mean, some of the movie is very, very interesting, like the scenes where they're like kind of inceptionizing New York. I did enjoy that, but it really is kind of a nothing burger. I'm afraid. I've tried to look at it a couple of different ways, and it just I can't do it. Okay, so now we're into, what is this? 18, Thor. Great casting of Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston as Thor and Loki. I mean, without them, I feel like the mere concept of Thor crumbles before our very eyes. It's also like Kenneth Branagh directed this, and of course, you know, Kenneth Branagh's filmography is like through 80s and 90s. He did a lot of these really great Shakespeare adaptations, and there's a really great Shakespearean element to this Thor story that I think it's kind of boxed in by the stuff happening on Earth with like the Natalie Portman character and the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, and it's like the film really didn't have enough confidence in itself to be as weird as it wanted, in much the same way Thor Ragnarok like just goes full tilt weird. Natalie Portman also wasn't great as the romantic interest. I like Kat Dennings a lot more, and I think so much more interesting if it had been Kat Dennings as the love interest. But of course, Kat Dennings doesn't necessarily fit the type, the mold for a romantic interest in a fantasy action movie, which is a shame because Natalie Portman, I think, when she gets into these big franchises, when you're talking about MCU, whether you're talking about Star Wars, I don't know if she likes them a lot, and I don't know if she brings necessarily her best game to them. All right, I'm going to try and get through these last few pretty quickly. So number 19 is Iron Man 2. It's kind of a misstep because I feel like they played it safe. There's a very famous Iron Man comic book story called Demon in a Bottle where Tony Stark becomes a full-blown alcoholic and then has to deal with that. I feel like they wanted to tell that story and then chickened out because there's certainly elements of it in the Iron Man 2 storyline. But yeah, it's not done well. It's trying to do too many things. It's setting up the broader universe. It's setting up S.H.I.E.L.D. It's setting up, like, it's doing, like, a portmanteau of the whole Demon in the Bottle storyline. You got Mickey Rourke. You have Sam Rockwell as the villains, and they're doing stuff. You have the Gary Shandling stuff. You know, the politics of being Iron Man. It's a lot. And I'm not sure it's juggled terribly well. So number 20 I have is Thor the Dark World, which I think probably has its act together in terms of tone better than the original Thor. But again, it's kind of like a nothing burger of a plot where nothing like really terribly substantive happens, which is weird because in this movie Thor's mother dies. But you never I think you can count on one hand the number of scenes that Chris Hemsworth and Rene Russo had together, and you could probably get three of your fingers blown off. There's really no payoff. And what's interesting, in without spoiling too much about Endgame, it's like Age of Ultron. Endgame kind of takes elements from the Dark World and shakes them up and sort of makes us go, huh, should we rewatch Dark World? I'm not sure I would recommend that, because I think what we get out of Endgame is fine. But again, the consequence-free nature of the MCU is a large part of where things kind of don't work as well with this movie. And finally, that brings us to The Incredible Hulk, which was kind of a co-production with Universal Studios, although it's set in the MCU. There's definitely a feeling that there wasn't a complete control. I have a feeling, too, that a lot of the best Bruce Banner stuff, like the stuff Edward Norton like was really workshopping it for that movie, was kind of left on the cutting room floor in favor of the action and all that. So you had Incredible Hulk that came out the same year as Iron Man. You had one that was really, really good. You had one that was kind of really not so good. I think Incredible Hulk has serviceable action. It's also shot in Toronto, too, and it's one of the rare times you see Toronto in the MCU playing New York. Most of the rest of the MCU movies have been shot around the Atlanta area. Cleveland, as well, has also been frequently used as a backdrop. So, anyway, I mean, so it's interesting in that regard. Edward Norton put in a decent effort, but again, I'm not sure whoever was like behind the release or the marketing of that movie really cared about Bruce Banner's inner life, which is a shame, because that's sort of where it takes off when we introduce Mark Ruffalo into the mix. Suddenly people are much more interested in Bruce Banner. Maybe it's because of the Mark Ruffalo charm and appeal. I don't know. Anyway, we will leave that there. Maybe I'll put the whole list on my Twitter feed in the order, so that you can take a look at that later, and you know, maybe you can tweet at me and disagree and stuff, or not. I'm not invested either way. Anyway, we're gonna take a break here, and then I'm going to rehydrate for the review of Avengers Endgame. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Use the stones again.
Hey, we'd be going in short-handed, you know.
Look, he's still got the stones, so.
So let's get him. Use them to bring everyone back.
Just like that.
Yeah, just like that.
Even if there's a small chance that we can undo this, I mean, we owe it to everyone who's not in this room to try.
If we do this, how do we know it's gonna end any differently than it did before?
Because before you didn't have me.
Hey, new girl. Everybody in this room is about that superhero life. And if you don't mind my asking, where the hell have you been all this time?
There are a lot of other planets in the universe. And unfortunately, they didn't have you guys.
I like this one. Let's go get this son of a bitch.
Language cap. Anyway, You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU, and that was a clip from Avengers Endgame, and it's a new film from Joe and Anthony Russo, and it stars everyone who's ever been in a Marvel movie ever, or almost everyone. It's interesting, too, because there are a lot of cameos and sort of small roles and appearances in the film that I don't want to spoil, and I won't spoil, but it really does feel like they tried to get as many as humanly possible into this, even some like very unexpected ones, which I appreciated a lot. So, I mean, that scene kind of teased things up nicely. I'm going to try and not spoil things, but that takes place very early in the film. And actually, if you hear the musical cue, it's actually right before the Avengers title card comes up that says Avengers Endgame. So you already have in the mix, you know, Captain Marvel, as you heard there. And it's really, really fun moment, her standing there, standing up to Thor. You have this really great propulsiveness going into the film. We are going to find Thanos. We are going to get the stones. We're going to undo this mess he did. As you recall, at the end of Infinity War, Thanos snaps his fingers and wipes out half of all life in the universe. And so this is where we pick up the few Avengers that are left, which are interestingly the six original members of the Avengers, oddly enough. Plus a few others like Rhodey and Rocket Raccoon and Nebula. They have to sort of pick up and try and get things back. And what I really appreciate of the film is that it does the thing you think will be done in the third act right up front. And then the rest of the film is about, well, now what do we do? There's a really fascinating three-act structure in this where you have the first hour, they're actually like dealing with the fallout of everything that happened in Infinity War. There's a lot of like examination of like PTSD and like grief and loss, and you have Captain America leading like a support group, sort of like using his skills. Like, well, I was gone for 7 years, and I appeared, and everyone I knew was dead, and you know, what do? You move on. Even though he kind of half-heartedly believes that, because there's a scene, and it's in some of the trailers too, where he's talking to Black Widow and he's saying, you know, I keep telling people to move on, but not us. We're not the ones who move on. And you also see there's a pretty surprising development with Thor as well, that, you know, he's been through so much. We're going through Thor Ragnarok, where Asgard is destroyed, and you know, half his people are killed, half the survivors, and how he's rebuilding. One of the really great treats, I think, of this film is Robert Downey Jr.'s performance. The film gives him a lot to do. That's not just, you know, kind of sitting there and being snarky and having cool one-liners, although that's still there. There's actually some surprisingly funny parts in this film, which I'll get to in a sec. But for the Robert Downey Jr. stuff, I feel like he's been coasting for the last few years, last few movies. And maybe that's because of boredom. Maybe that's because, you know, I don't know. They don't really want to give him too much to do. They don't want to try to upset the apple cart too much. But he does a lot of the heavy lifting here, which is surprising. And I'm grateful for, because, you know, you are kind of reminded that Robert Downey Jr. isn't just a brand. He's a very talented actor when you give him the right material. And I think everyone does really good here. Surprisingly, I'm very up on this movie, despite considering how down I was on Infinity War. And like I said, like, Endgame doesn't really change my feelings about Infinity War. You know, it is what it is, I guess. If what I will say is that if having to go through the slog of Infinity War is what gets us here, fine, I can live with that. The humor. There's a lot of great humor in this film, as you would expect from a Marvel Universe movie. I noticed this in particular with Captain Marvel, that sometimes the need to go for the zinger sometimes overwhelms, like, a dramatic moment. It seems to be a thing where we can't just, like, have serious moments unless somebody, like, puns or someone makes a crack or something. But so, you know, coming out of this movie, I was really glad that it found a balance. It found a balance between being jokey and being serious and not letting one undermine the other. That, you know, if it was a lighthearted moment, it was called for, it allowed it, and it wasn't trying to undermine the drama. It let the drama happen. It kind of let, you know, you kind of wallow in things, which I appreciated. Because I have a feeling that the Russos aren't necessarily sort of, and maybe it's because, you know, the three out of the four movies they've made, they've kind of been saddled with these, like, big, huge cast of thousands kind of dramas, where they have to, you know, sort of be so aware of who's physically where that they can't just sort of have a moment where people can chill out and just, you know, hang out. And, you know, they get some of that back in this movie. So maybe they are kind of the concept of it kind of allows them to do that. I'm just going to look at my notes here. What else have I got here? You know what? There's a lot of great callbacks too, I'll say. and that goes along with a lot of the cameos too, but there are a lot of great callbacks. Plus, there are a lot of things that I think as a comic book fan, I've wanted to see in these movies for a great long while, and they haven't done. And among those is a certain phrase said by a certain someone in the final battle sequence, which even made me a little giddy. As sort of cynical as I might have slightly become, I'm not like Vince-level cynical about comic movies, obviously, but certainly about some of these Marvel ones, I have sort of a more cynical eye. I think that this is like a really fitting conclusion. I think that it really pays off. I think the best analogy I can think of is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, the two-parter there. Although it's Deathly Hallows Part 2 is kind of all action. It's like a two-hour action sequence, pretty much, where you go from the break-in at the Wizard Bank, and that kind of like goes right into the siege at Hogwarts. The style is kind of similar to that with like in between Infinity War and Endgame, but I think Endgame is sensitive enough to like not go whole hog. The first like really big major action sequence is actually the climactic fight. It is actually the end, where they are fighting the villain, and there's a real weight and sense of consequence to this. And maybe it's because you're bringing into the external idea that this is the last Avengers movie, or maybe the last with this cast of Avengers. There will certainly be more Avengers movies, and there will certainly be more Marvel movies. But you know, you're bringing into this the idea, the external idea that Robert Downey Jr. is probably looking to get out, Scarlett Johansson's looking to get out, Chris Evans looking to get out, Chris Hemsworth's looking to get out, and you know, you sort of feel that, you know, maybe the end is nigh for some of these characters. I mean, obviously, Black Panther is scheduled to carry on, as our Guardians of the Galaxy has a Spider-Man movie actually comes out in 2 months. So there you go. There's that kind of knowledge sort of keeps you back from like feeling genuine stakes, but that doesn't go all the way. I think that was a big thing that was holding Infinity War back for me, is that, you know, knowing that, yes, poof, there goes Black Panther, poof, there goes Spider-Man, poof, there goes Falcon, and you know that, you know, these people are tied to contracts and are going to be involved in these series for years and years and years to come. But it's a bit different in this one. And, you know, granted, some plot mechanics are in play that, you know, can make you think, like, no one is really gone in these films. But having said that, there are a couple of very key send-offs that if you're a fan of these movies, they will wreck you in a certain extent. That, you know, there is finality in this movie. That there are consequences, which, again, is something I think these movies have been lacking all along. What I find is that there's a great arc here for Tony Stark. There's a good arc here for Captain America. Bruce Banner as the Hulk. There's some really interesting developments there. Scott bringing back Paul Rudd as Scott Lang, the Ant-Man, is a lot of fun. Karen Gillan gets a lot of great moments as Nebula, as well as Thanos's daughter, who obviously has mixed issues about her father. There's a really great scene involving a character giving another character a couple of tacos, which is kind of touching, that I enjoy too. I think the story works fine. I think the technical achievement is incredible. I think, you know, there are a couple of scenes in this movie where if someone wanted to take out half the stars in Hollywood, if they knew the details of when certain scenes were being shot on certain days, they could have eliminated half of Hollywood right there. So the sheer technical achievement of getting all these people on a single soundstage at a single time is really quite monumentous. And, you know, I think you walk away feeling satisfied. I walk away feeling satisfied. I haven't found myself invested in every aspect of the journey of this. But having said that, I feel deeply satisfied with how it wraps up and where it leaves things. And I don't think I was really expecting that. I think when you kind of get past the Cooglers and the YTTs, you know, the people who are kind of bringing their own style and vision to these films, you sort of feel the bare mechanics of the Marvel machine. And this movie has some of that, but it also covers it up fairly well, that, you know, there's a compelling emotional arc and an emotional story to all this. So it's a very satisfying conclusion to a 22-movie journey. 22 movies, 11 years, however many hours that is. I mean, and Avengers Endgame 2 is a three-hour investment, but I found that the three hours really flew by. It's kind of like Titanic that way, where when you kind of get into the journey and it propels you and it launches you, the time kind of flies by and you just become very invested in this story and in these characters. And I think as fans, you are left satisfied, or at least I was left satisfied. You know, you can let me know if you disagree or not, but I enjoyed Avengers Endgame, and I look forward to seeing what Marvel does next, because I hope they can sort of maybe try some new things, try some different directions, but we will see. And that's it for this edition of End Credits, and we hope you like it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media at Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can check out my political stuff at GuelphPolitico.ca. And we will have a co-host next week. I'm proud to say we're going to be reviewing The Long Shot, Tim and I. So we're a little bit of a departure from some of the superhero malaise. So stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits. And we'll see you then.